You're listening to an episode of a Wondery Plus exclusive series. To continue listening, join Wondery Plus and enjoy ad-free listening to over 40,000 episodes, early access to your favorite podcasts, and more. Find Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts.
It's 1966 and close to midnight in the foothills of Palo Alto, California. Bill Pitts creeps up the quiet, moonlit road. Pitts spotted the road earlier today and followed it to a low-rise, semicircular building. He's been a student at Stanford for 2 years, but he only noticed this place this evening, and he doesn't have a clue what's inside. That's part of the fun. Pitts gets his kicks from exploring restricted areas of the university. He loves the thrill of being where he shouldn't be. He's picked locks on buildings across the university, climbed to the very top of the Hoover Tower, and spent hours crawling around the steam tunnels underneath the campus. Now, his heart beats faster as he nears the top of the hill. But when the facility comes into view, Pitts freezes in his tracks. The lights are on. Cautiously, he approaches the entrance and tries the door. It's unlocked. Pitts feels cheated, but having come all this way, he might as well see what's inside. He clips his Stanford ID badge onto his leather jacket and starts down the curving corridor. There's no sign of life. He presses on toward the double doors at the center of the building. The sign above them reads, Main Hall. He swings them open and finds he's just stepped into the future. The hall is vast, windowless, and bathed in a harsh fluorescent light. An enormous mainframe computer dominates the room. Tall blue cabinets filled with the computer's electronics line the walls. At the top of each cabinet, LED lights blink on and off like something from the deck of the Starship Enterprise. At a desk near one of the computer's cabinets, two men sit wrapped at a circular computer monitor, bouncing in their chairs with excitement. Pitts is still staring open-mouthed when another man calls over to him.
You need something, young man? You don't have to hide by the doorway.
What is this place?
This is SAIL, Stanford Artificial Intelligence Laboratory.
One of the men around the computer monitor shouts.
Damn it.
What are they doing?
They're playing Space War. It's a computer game. You're using all of this to play a game?
The man shrugs.
After hours, we can do what we like.
Pitts is speechless. In 1966, computers are impersonal number crunchers. Serious machines used by serious people in the name of science, commerce, or nuclear war. Pitts thrills at the idea of taking such an instrument and turning it into a plaything. Just 10 minutes ago, he was plotting to break into this lab. Soon, he'll have a very different mission, helping these games break out.
If I asked you how many subscriptions you have, would you be able to list all of them and how much you're paying? If you would have asked me this question before I started using Rocket Money, I would have said yes. But let me tell you, I would have been so wrong. I can't believe how many I had and all the money I was wasting. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/Wondery. rocketmoney.com/Wondery.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
From Wondery, I'm Stephen Johnson, and this is American Innovations. Today, video games are everywhere. They take over our TVs, they live on our computers, and thanks to our phones, they go where we go. But where did they come from? And how did they take over our screens? In this series, we explore the innovations that started the video game invasion. It's a story that began in the 1950s and 60s, when the first generation of programmers began coding games for themselves to play. Few of them imagined that computer games would ever escape the computer lab. After all, computers were enormous, they cost hundreds of thousands of dollars, and the invention of the microprocessor was still years away. But the pioneers of the video game industry weren't going to let a little detail like that stop them. And in realizing their sci-fi visions of electronic play, they would do more than change the entertainment industry. They would also blaze the trail for the Silicon Valley tech moguls of today. This is episode one of their story, Electric Dreams. It's 1968, and Bill Pitts parks outside the Stanford Artificial Intelligence Laboratory in Palo Alto, California. He switches off the car engine and turns to his pal, Hugh Tuck.
You're gonna love this place.
Tuck's a skinny guy with thick, black, round glasses. Pitts has known him since high school, and he's been waiting for him to visit from his own university a few hours away.
So this is why you're never home when I call.
Yeah, come on. Pitts leads Tuck into the semicircular building. Since discovering Sale, he's struggled to pry himself away. Sale's director lets him use the computers whenever the researchers aren't using them. So now he skips class to sleep during the day and spends his nights in the lab. And he's dying to show his best friend around. As they head down the corridor to the main hall, a man in his 60s strolls past. Pitts turns to Tuck. That's Arthur Samuel. He's a legend around these parts. He's got this big idea about machines that learn, and get this, he's made a computer program that plays checkers, and I'm helping him with it.
Wow, does it play other games?
Pitts grins.
Oh yeah, it does. I have got to show you Space War. It's the best. That one you play on the screen, it'll blow your mind.
He sits his friend down at the computer monitor.
Wait there, I'll get the controllers.
Tuck stares at the image on the screen. It's like a TV, but circular instead of square. It reminds him of a radar screen. Pitts returns with two small wooden boxes, each with switches and buttons on the top. He plugs them into the machine and hands one to Tuck.
That's a controller. So Space War is a space battle game, you versus me. We both get a spaceship to control. Those two buttons there rotate your ship left or right, and the switch is for forward thrust, and that one's reverse thrust. And you press this button to fire. You got it?
Think so.
Good. I just need to load the game and we're ready.
Pitts takes a fan-folded strip of paper tape, feeds it into the computer, and flicks a switch. The machine rapidly pulls the paper tape through the reader. After the computer's finished reading the code, which is hole-punched into the paper tape, the monitor comes to life. Tuck stares at the image on the monitor. A landscape of distant stars, and in the middle of the screen, a rapidly pulsating blue-white mass.
What's that? That's the sun. It exerts gravity, so be careful not to get pulled into it, because if that happens, you're dead. So you ready?
Tuck tightens his grip on the controller.
Yeah, I'm ready.
Pitts flicks a switch, and suddenly the outlines of two bright blue-white spaceships appear. One's long and tall like a redstone rocket. The other, a curvy spaceship, straight out of a pulp sci-fi novel. Tuck presses down on the thrust button and gasps as his redstone rocket starts moving fast. He really is in control of what's happening on a screen. He watches stunned as his rocket moves across the computer monitor, leaving a ghostly yellow-green trail in its wake. The trail reminds him of a sparkler firework. Mesmerized, he watches his space rocket arc left and right, just as he's directing it to. Tuck shakes off his amazement and turns his ship to fire at Pitts. He flicks a switch and a small dot launches from his rocket ship, closing in on Pitts. But then the gravitational pull of the sun in the middle of the screen drags Tuck's missile off course.
Darn! Pitts deftly slingshots his spacecraft around the pulsating sun to put himself right behind Tuck and lets rip with the fire button. Tuck's ship silently shatters into a cloud of phosphorescent pixels. Ah! The two pals spend the next hour glued to the screen, absorbed in a virtual battle for interstellar supremacy. When they finally put the controllers down, Tuck turns to Pitts.
That was ace. Who made it?
Pitts points to a 30-something guy hunched over a keyboard at the far end of the room.
That guy over there. He's Slug. Well, we all call him Slug, but his real name's Steve Russell. He wrote it in 62 with some friends when he was at MIT. He brought the game with him when he came here, but I've heard it's now in computer labs all over the country.
Tuck looks at Pitts.
You know, if we could take Space War and put it into an amusement arcade, we'd make a fortune. It'd be way better than those pinball machines and shooting galleries. Oh yeah, people's jaws would hit the ground if we put this in an arcade.
Pitts isn't wrong. In the late 1960s, arcade halls are free of screens and full of electrically powered mechanical games, like pinball tables, claw cranes, and games where players use toy rifles to shoot at moving targets. Next to those machines, Space War would look like something beamed down from outer space. Tuck thinks for a moment.
But seriously, could we do it?
Pitts shakes his head.
Not a chance. I mean, the computers here cost at least $500,000. Besides, look at the size of it. It'll need a whole arcade to itself. So, do you want to go get a beer?
Pitts and Tuck forget the daydream of bringing Space War into the arcades. But then, 2 years later, Pitts reads about a development that promises to change everything. And soon after, he's on the phone to Tuck.
Hugh, it's Phil. I had to call you. The Digital Equipment Corporation's launched a new computer called the PDP-11. Okay, that's great. Listen, it's a mini computer, so it's only about the size of a large desk. And best of all, it costs just $20,000. All right. Don't you get it? With a computer like that, we can build a Space War machine for the arcades.
Tuck finally gets it.
Really? Yeah, I checked into it. There are other cheaper computers out there, but none of them would be powerful enough to run Space War. Okay, but $20,000 sounds like a lot of money. A pinball machine's gotta cost way less than that. Sure, but here's the thing. The PDP-11's so powerful, we could hook it up to 4 monitors and get it to run 4 Space War games at the same time. Each game lasts about a minute, so we'll have 4 games, each with 2 players, and each player paying a dime a go, which makes $48 an hour. Right. So, yeah, it'll take a while to recoup the costs, but it's doable, right?
Yeah. It could work. I mean, Space War's so good, people will be playing it nonstop, won't they?
Exactly. The real problem is finding the money to buy a PDP-11 so we can test the idea out.
Tuck thinks for a moment.
You know, I think my folks might be willing to loan it to us. I can ask them. Let me give them a call right now. I'll phone you back.
Pitts and Tuck are on their way. But they're not the only ones dreaming of bringing Space War to the masses. It's 1970 in Santa Clara, California. Nolan Bushnell and Ted Dabney are spending their lunch break at a new pizzeria. They're both engineers for an audio-visual tech company called Ampex. But that's where the similarities between them end. Bushnell's 27, with shaggy hair down to his chin and a head full of dreams. Dabney's 6 years older with glasses, a neatly trimmed horseshoe mustache, and a practical mindset. It's a good combo. Bushnell is the one who comes up with big new ideas, and Dabney steers those ideas towards something tangible. Dabney examines his slice of pizza, then takes a bite.
It's all right. A little greasy. What do you think? It's fine.
Dabney raises an eyebrow. Bushnell's usually got more to say than that. They're here for research. Bushnell's latest plan is to open a chain of pizzerias full of coin-operated games. He thinks children will love it because of the games, and parents will appreciate the games giving them a respite from their kids. So they're getting familiar with the pizza trade, checking out how other restaurants operate. But Bushnell's mind is elsewhere.
You okay, Nolan? You seem distracted.
Bushnell puts his pizza slice down and looks Dabney in the eyes.
A few days ago, a friend took me to see the Stanford computer lab he works in. It's up in the hills near Felt Lake. Sale? Yeah, that's the one. And while we're there, we play this game on the computer. It's called Space War. And it's fantastic. I can't stop thinking about it. Dabney can sense Bushnell's going somewhere with this. He sits back to listen. This is why he likes hanging out with Bushnell. He never knows what the guy will think of next. So, playing the game got me thinking about when I was at the University of Utah. I worked summers at this amusement park, looking after the arcade games. And I know if I put Space War in that park, people would go crazy for it. They'll drop every coin they have into it. I tell you, if there was a way to put Space War into an arcade, it will transform the business. Overnight. Dabney interrupts. But Nolan, computers are expensive. You can't put a computer in an arcade and make money.
Bushnell pulls a folded up piece of paper from his suit pocket.
Yeah, that's what I thought. But then I saw this.
Bushnell hands Dabney a flyer. The flyer's an ad for a new computer called the Data General Nova. Price? $4,000.
It's not the most powerful computer around, but it's definitely the cheapest. I'm thinking if we can get that computer to run 4 games at once, it'll pay its way in the arcades. And if we can make it do that, we'll make a lot of money. But I'm not a computer programmer. Ted, do you know anything about computers?
No, but there's a guy back at the office, Larry Bryan. I think he does.
Soon after, Bushnell and Dabney convince Bryan to join their venture. Bushnell will handle electrical engineering, Dabney, video engineering, and Bryan will program the computer. The race to take Space War out of the computer lab and into the arcades is on. But the two rival teams are about to take drastically different paths. One team will try to create the games of the future with the most cutting-edge technology of the day. And the other team will find themselves using technology that's so commonplace, it's already in their house.
Looking to instantly upgrade your Mother's Day gift from typical to meaningful? Shop Etsy. Get up to 30% off well-crafted and personalized gifts from participating shops until May 12th. This year, embrace your creative side. You know, the side your mom gave you. And shop Etsy for custom jewelry, style pieces, home decor, and extra special items she'll adore. Need something original and affordable for Mother's Day? Etsy has it. Shop until May 12th for up to 30% off gifts for mom. Terms apply.
Have you ever covered a carpet stain with a rug? Ignored a leaky faucet? Pretended your half-painted living room is supposed to look like that? Well, you're not alone. We've all got unfinished home projects. But there's an easier way. When you download Thumbtack, it's easier to care for your home from top to bottom. Pull out your phone and in just a few steps, you can search, chat, and book highly rated pros right in your neighborhood. Plus, you'll know what to tackle next, because Thumbtack is the app that shows you what to do, who to hire, and when. So say goodbye to all those unfinished home projects and say hello to caring for your home the easier way. Download Thumbtack and start a project today.
It's January 1971, and Nolan Bushnell is at home feeling despondent. He slumps on the sofa staring at the TV, but he's paying no attention to what he's watching. Instead, he's thinking about Space War. Bushnell's plan to use the $4,000 Data General Nova computer to bring Space War to the arcades is a bust. It didn't take long to become clear that the price of the Nova was too good to be true. The computer's slow, real slow. Too slow to update a screen at anything close to the speed needed for an action game like Space War. Bushnell spent months looking for a solution. He's used transistors and other electronic components to build circuits that ease the burden on the underpowered computer. Like one that generates the background stars on the screen without the Nova having to do anything. But it hasn't been enough. The only alternative is using a faster, more expensive computer. But Bushnell knows that a higher-priced machine won't fly with arcade owners. So he's given up. He figures he's just too ahead of the times. Sure, one day computers might get cheap and fast enough to bring Space War into the arcades, but right now, in 1971, that's still the stuff of science fiction. He stares at the TV screen and frowns. The picture's gone out of sync. The image is now repeatedly slipping down the screen before bouncing back up. He heads to the TV set and kneels down in front of the control panel next to the screen. Amid the dials for tuning in TV stations and adjusting brightness is one labeled Vertical Hold. It and its sister dial, Horizontal Hold, are familiar to every early 70s television owner. They correct the TV picture when it gets out of sync, which is pretty often. Bushnell twists the vertical hold dial, and the picture snaps back into place. And that gives him a bright idea. He
He rushes over to his phone and calls Dabney.
Dabney residence.
Hey, Ted, it's Nolan. I've got an idea. You know the vertical and horizontal hold controls on TV sets?
Sure.
How do they work? How come the picture moves up and down when I adjust the vertical hold?
It's because the cathode ray tube in the TV gets out of whack with the incoming picture. So it starts painting what should be the top of the image too far down the screen. The dial moves the picture back in sync with the broadcast.
So there are ways to move an image around a screen without using a computer. Ted, what if that's how we make Space War?
You mean make the game out of hardware, not software? Make a computer game without a computer.
Dabney pauses for a moment, thinking.
Yeah, that could actually work. We could make an electronic circuit with the video generator to display a spot on the screen. Then we could use a timer to deliberately knock the video generator out of sync so that spot changes position.
Bushnell cuts in. And if that works, we use similar circuits to make more spots so we can draw spaceships or anything else we want in the game and...
Yeah, this could be it, Nolan.
And the technology was here all along. We never needed a computer.
This is the breakthrough moment. Instead of coding their game, Bushnell and Dabney are going to solder and wire it together using everyday electronic components. Things like resistors and diodes and transistors. They're ditching software engineering for electrical engineering. Within weeks, they've built a proof of concept. A circuit generates a lone spot on a television screen. Then, using dials, they can move that dot around the screen. They call it spot motion technology, and it's way cheaper than any computer. Each of the components it uses can be bought for a few cents in an electronics store. Suddenly, the video game revolution that seemed years away is possible, right here, right now. Bushnell and Dabney just need someone to help them get it into the arcades. It's February 1971 in Mountain View, California, and Nolan Bushnell's at the dentist. He's on his back, mouth full of cotton, squinting against the bright overhead lamp. The dentist's masked face looms into view.
Open wider. Okay.
The dentist inserts his handheld mirror into Bushnell's mouth.
So, what line of work are you in, Mr. Bushnell?
Electrical engineering.
The dentist withdraws the mouth mirror.
I'm sorry, I didn't catch that.
Electrical engineering.
Ah, working on anything interesting?
Yeah, I'm creating a new kind of game for the arcades. A game you play on the TV screen.
Open up.
The dentist pulls the damp balls of cotton wool out of Bushnell's mouth with his tweezers.
All done. You can rinse now.
Bushnell sits up and starts rinsing. The dentist drops the cotton wool in the trash and heads to his desk to write his notes.
So, a TV game. That sounds unusual. Not sure I've seen one before.
You haven't. This is going to be the first, and it's going to change the arcades. All I need to do now is find a manufacturer to bring it into the arcades.
The dentist looks up from his notes.
Actually, I've got another patient you should talk to. He does sales for a company called Nutting Associates. They make coin-operated games, and they're just a few blocks from here. I'll get you his number.
A few days later, Nolan Bushnell's in the Mountain View offices of Nutting Associates, getting ready to demo spot motion technology. Watching him is Nutting Associates' 45-year-old founder, Bill Nutting. He's a former Army Air Corps pilot who got into the arcade machine business back in 1967. Nutting scored big with his first game, Computer Quiz. Despite the name, there was no computer inside his coin-operated quiz machine, just a slide projector. But that didn't stop it from becoming a runaway success. Nutting sold more than 4,000 computer quiz machines to arcades nationwide, double what even a hit pinball table sells. But now Nutting desperately needs another hit game. His business is sliding towards oblivion. He's hoping Bushnell might be the lifeline he needs. Bushnell powers up the TV and turns to Nutting.
Okay, here we go.
Nutting leans forward in his chair. As Bushnell adjusts the tuner dial, the static gives way to silence and a black screen with a fuzzy white spot in the middle. Bushnell tweaks the tuner dial again, and the spot comes into focus. Next, he twists the dial connected to the circuit he rigged up to the TV set. The spot on the screen moves right. Bushnell twists a second dial, and the spot moves up the screen. Nutting stares, open-mouthed. Bushnell offers him the controls.
Here, you have a go.
Nutting plays with the dials, awestruck. It's not much of a game, But just being able to control an image on a TV screen feels like sorcery. Nutting turns to Bushnell.
This is amazing.
Bushnell smiles.
I call it spot motion technology. With this technology, it's possible to create TV games for the arcades. The first game I'm going to make will be a rocket ship game. You fly around in space, blasting another spaceship.
Nutting is still wrapping his head around what he's seeing.
How's it done?
Bushnell keeps it vague. He hasn't patented it yet.
It's all done using the dedicated electronic circuits that I designed. My technology works with any TV set, and believe me, it's going to change the arcades forever. Once TV games arrive, the arcades will be unrecognizable.
Nutting is sold.
Okay, Nolan, I'm impressed. How much do you want for this technology?
Bushnell stifles a smile.
Oh, it's not for sale.
Nutting leans forward.
Come on, Nolan, name a price. You're not just showing me this stuff for fun, are you?
Bushnell remains poker-faced. There's no way he's selling what he believes is the biggest development in arcade gaming since pinball just for a fast buck.
Like I said, the technology isn't for sale, but I will license the game I'm making with it to you.
Nutting pauses. The technology's impressive, but right now, there's no game, so he's not sure exactly what he's buying.
I need to think about this. I'll be in touch.
The next day, Bushnell gets a call at his home from Nutting.
Nolan, I've got an offer for you. Come work for me, become my chief engineer, and make your game at my facility. I'll pay double what you're getting at Ampex.
All right, Bill, I'll take your offer, but on three conditions.
Name them.
One, the game and the technology remain mine. I work on the game at your facility, but only outside working hours, and I won't take a penny from you toward the cost of developing it.
Done. What else?
I will license the exclusive right to manufacture and sell the game to you. In return, I get a 5% royalty on sales.
Nutting grimaces, but he knows releasing the first TV game is his company's best shot at survival.
Fine. What's the third condition?
Bushnell pauses. He only had two conditions. He racks his brain for something more to squeeze out of Nutting.
And I want a company car.
Nutting says nothing. Bushnell holds his tongue. Then Nutting finally breaks the silence.
Fine, you get a car. I'll send you the contract.
It's March 1971, and in Sunnyvale, California, it's Nolan Bushnell's last day at Ampex. Ted Dabney watches as his pal packs his personal belongings into a cardboard box.
It won't be the same here without you, Nolan.
Bushnell looks at Dabney.
It's not too late, Ted. Come to Nutting with me.
Dabney strokes his horseshoe mustache.
Nolan, you're just out of college. I've been at Ampex 10 years. It's a good job, a secure job, and Nutting's a big leap into the unknown. I'm not sure it's for me.
Bushnell gives Dabney an uncomprehending look.
Okay, your choice. But you'll keep helping me out on the side, right?
Of course. It's still our project.
Over the next few months, Bushnell settles into a new routine. He spends his days troubleshooting Nutting Associates' engineering headaches. Then, he devotes his evenings to the game he believes will press play on the video game revolution. The spot on the screen becomes a spaceship. Circuits that produce sound are soldered together, and Bushnell uses modeling clay to design a futuristic fiberglass cabinet for the game. Nutting christens the game Computer Space after his earlier hit, Computer Quiz. After seeing Bushnell's rapid progress with Computer Space, Dabney overcomes his fears. In the summer of 1971, he resigns from Ampex so he can join his friend at Nutting Associates. Day by day, Bushnell's dream of making the first coin-operated video game is coming true. But then he gets word through the tech grapevine that he's got competition. Two other guys are trying to bring Space War to the arcades. The news sends shivers down Bushnell's spine. He spent 2 years chasing the video game dream, convinced he was ahead of the curve. But what if he's actually the one who needs to play catch-up?
You can host the best backyard barbecue when you find a professional on Angie to make your backyard the best around. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Inside to outside, repairs to renovations. Get started on the Angie app or visit Angie.com today. You can do this when you Angie that.
It's an August evening in 1971, and in Mountain View, California, a security guard leads Bill Pitts and Hugh Tuck through Nutting Associates' facility. The two friends are nervous. It's been a year since they bought a PDP-11 computer and began transforming it into a coin-operated space war machine. They call their version Galaxy Game, and it's almost ready to roll. But they've just learned someone else is trying to do the exact same thing, and they've been invited here to meet him. They have no idea what to expect. The security guard stops at an office with an open door.
That's Mr. Bushnell's workshop.
Pitts and Tuck peek through the door. Inside, the man who must be Nolan Bushnell is jabbing an oscilloscope probe into the back guts of a tall, futuristic arcade cabinet. Pitt's jaw drops at the sight of the machine. It's like a strange, amorphous alien with a TV screen for a face.
Way out. Is that your game?
Before Bushnell can reply, Pitts makes for Computer Space's tall, pineapple-yellow fiberglass cabinet and runs a hand down its smooth curves.
It's like something out of Barbarella. Sorry, Nolan, I'm Bill. He's Hugh.
The men know that, on paper, they're competitors. But standing in front of Bushnell's creation, Pitts knows they're also fellow geeks. Pitts turns back to the machine as he talks.
So, your version's called Computer Space. Ours is Galaxy Game.
Bushnell rubs the back of his neck. He's not sure how much he wants to divulge yet. But after spending more than a year trying to bring Space War to the arcades, he's also desperate to compare notes.
Yeah, my boss picked that name. It's kind of funny because it doesn't use a computer.
Pitt spins back around to look at Bushnell.
What? You're making Space War without a computer?
Bushnell blinks in shock.
Wait, you two are making an arcade game with a computer? Yeah, we're using a PDP-11. Oh, that's got to be expensive. How much is that?
Tuck speaks up.
$20,000, give or take.
Bushnell looks confused.
How are you ever going to make that money back? The PDP-11 can run four games at once, so Galaxy Game will have eight players at the same time. But people won't be playing it nonstop.
Tuck smiles.
We thought of that. The winner of each game gets a free go. That way it'll always be in use.
Bushnell tries not to raise his eyebrows. It'll always be in use, but only one competitor's paying? He's no longer worried about Pitts and Tuck at all. He'll be amazed if Galaxy Game breaks even, let alone turns a profit. He changes the subject.
So, you guys want to try Computer Space?
Yeah. As Bushnell turns on the machine, Pitt stares at the controls.
There's only one set of controls. Where's the other? There isn't another. Computer Space is one player.
Pitts and Tuck exchange glances.
Single player? That's not Space War. Space War is head-to-head combat with another human being.
Pitt squints as Computer Space's screen comes to life. The game's primitive visuals are nothing like the sharp, high-resolution computer monitor graphics he's used to. He watches as two crude flying saucers bounce around against a background of square stars. He turns to Bushnell.
Flying saucers? There are no flying saucers in Space War.
Bushnell shrugs.
Sure, it's not exactly Space War, but it's close enough. Here's a quarter for the coin slot.
At the mention of a quarter, Tuck's eyes widen. In every arcade he's ever set foot in, games cost 10 cents, not 25.
You're charging a quarter? Yeah, I used to work in an amusement park. You put the right game in front of people, they'll pay a quarter.
Pitts drops a quarter into the slot and starts the game. Pitts watches as his spaceship moves sluggishly around the screen and the flying saucers blink in and out of existence. He dies over and over as he battles to master the game's clunky buttons. And the longer he plays, the more confident he feels about Galaxy Game. Computer Space is a mere shadow of Space War. Galaxy Game's the real deal and a way better game. Side by side in an arcade, Pitts is certain people will choose his game, not Bushnell's. It's October 1971, and in Chicago, the coin-op industry's annual trade show is underway in the Sherman House Hotel. On the exhibition floor, jukeboxes and slot machines vie with claw cranes and pinball tables for attention. This year, Nutting Associates hopes to steal the show with the launch of Bushnell and Dabney's Computer Space. After a short and successful test run at the Dutch Goose Bar near Stanford University, Computer Space is ready for its national debut. And its display of space-age, glittering metallic video game machines soon gets attention. As one curious arcade owner approaches one of the Computer Space cabinets, Nutting's sales chief pounces.
"This, sir, is Computer Space, the start of the TV game age."
The arcade owner looks confused.
"TV game?" "Yes, the entire game takes place on the TV screen in the cabinet. It's got no moving parts, so it's easy to maintain. Take a closer look, it won't bite."
The man peers at the ghostly outlines moving around the screen.
"What are those? UFOs?" "Yes. After all, what kid can resist anything to do with space? Also, since this game is so advanced, you can charge a quarter per play. It'll send your takings into the stratosphere." "So how do you play it?" "So right, you've got to fly your spaceship around the screen and shoot the UFOs. Right here is the fire missile button, that explains itself. You press thrust to move, and then you use the two rotate buttons here to steer. Hit that white button to start."
The arcade owner palms the white button. A UFO zooms past and zaps his spaceship.
"Hey!"
A second later, he's got a new ship. He hits the thrust. His spacecraft zooms off the side of the screen and reappears on the other side.
"Huh?"
Confused, he presses a rotate button. His spaceship spins around and around while slowly drifting through space. Then, the UFO zaps it again.
Sorry, this game is really confusing." "Okay, sure, it takes some getting used to. But in our first test location, it made more than $50 a week." "$50? Well, it's got novelty value. Maybe it can get me some extra foot traffic. All right, put me down for one."
By the show's end, Nutting's got hundreds of Computer Space orders. It's no smash hit, but it's strong enough to keep Nutting Associates in business. But just as Computer Space enters the arcades, Bill Pitts and Hugh Tuck's Galaxy game makes its debut. It's November 1971 at the Treasurer's Student Union at Stanford University. A new arrival in the music listening room is causing a commotion. An excited crowd is clustered around a large homemade arcade machine encased in wood, and they're all straining to watch the space battles taking place on screen. Galaxy Game only got switched on this morning, but it's already caused a storm. Students are feeding dime after dime into its coin box and battling each other in space death matches as their friends egg them on. Watching from the sidelines are Pitts and Tuck, and they've got huge smiles on their faces. They did it. They brought Space War, the real Space War, to the public. Pitts turns to Tuck.
"Imagine these guys being this excited about that Computer Space game." "Yeah, two people fighting head-to-head, it makes all the difference."
Pitts nods. An engineering student approaches them and raises his glass in salute.
"Kudos to you guys. My entire class has been here all day. We've been debating. The stars in the background, are they from a real star chart? Sure looks like it."
Pitts and Tuck bask in the glow of their game's debut all night. It feels like victory. 6 miles across town, Bushnell is also feeling optimistic about the future. Nutting Associates has won orders for several hundred Computer Space machines, but the mood in the office is about to change fast. It's December 1971. In his office in Mountain View, California, Bill Nutting is on the phone with the arcade game distributor Empire.
"I'm putting you on speakerphone because my chief engineer, Nolan Bushnell, is here with me. So, how's Computer Space going down with the arcade owners?"
A voice comes out of the phone.
"They're not happy, Bill. We're hearing the takings are much lower than your claims about the location tests. People find the game confusing and difficult."
Nutting fiddles with his tie.
"Well, when we tested it at the Dutch Goose, people got it just fine."
"Dutch Goose? Where's that?"
"Oh, it's not far from here. It's near Stanford University."
"Well, there you go, a bar full of university students. Bill, people shouldn't need a college degree to play an arcade game."
Bushnell jumps in.
It's Nolan here. You need to think big picture. Computer Space is the future. It's the start of a new era. All those mechanical games you sell now, they're going to be obsolete."
"Oh, geez, Nolan. You're a funny guy. But listen, I'm telling you, there is no future in TV games. If that day ever comes, I'll eat my hat."
In early 1972, new orders for Computer Space start drying up. Nutting fires his chief salesman in response, and sales plunge even more. Bushnell's TV game revolution stalls. But luckily for him, Galaxy Game doesn't make it past the starting line. Despite a loyal following among tech-savvy Stanford students, Pitts and Tuck find Galaxy Game is little more than a money pit. They've just got one very expensive machine offering cheap plays. They have no sales team. They've got no manufacturing capability. And thanks to the expensive computer inside Galaxy Game, no hope of recovering the money they've spent making it. Galaxy Game remains trapped in Stanford's Trezor. The video game revolution that it and Computer Space were meant to spark didn't ignite. If anything, Computer Space has had the opposite effect, convincing many in the arcade business that TV games are a dead end. But after a year at Nutting Associates, Bushnell's come to a different conclusion. He thinks Bill Nutting screwed it up with poor leadership. So now, Bushnell's decided there's only one way forward. He needs to strike out on his own. On the next episode, Home Gaming escapes from a military research lab, Bushnell encounters a new competitor, and Atari bootstraps its way to the top. From Wondery, this is episode 1 of Video Games for American Innovations. If you like our show, please give us a 5-star rating and a review, and be sure to tell your friends. Subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, the Wondery app, or wherever you're listening right now. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app to listen ad-free. In the episode notes, you'll find some links and offers from our sponsors. Please support them. Another way you can support the show is by filling out a small survey at wondery.com/survey and tell us which innovation stories you'd like to hear. And a quick note about recreations you've been hearing. In most cases, we can't know exactly what was said. Those scenes are dramatizations, but they're based on historical research. American Innovations is hosted by me, Stephen Johnson. For more information on my books about science and innovation, including my book Wonderland, which covers a lot of material on the history of games, you can visit my website, stephenberlinjohnson.com, or follow me on Twitter at Stephen B. Johnson. Sound design on this episode is by Landon Lipinski. This episode was written by Tristan Donovan, with editing by Liza Veal. Produced by Natalie Shisha. Executive produced by Jenny Lauer Beckman, Marshall Louis, and Hernan Lopez for Wondery.
Once upon a beat. Remember the stories and fables that captured your imagination when you were young? We have a perfect podcast to bring you the stories you remember, remixed and reimagined for the kids in your life today. Yeah. Wondery and Tinkercast are bringing you a music-filled weekly party hosted by me,
DJ Fuge,
and my trusty turntable, Baby Scratch, spinning tales in the New Kids and Family podcast, Once Upon a Beat, where hip-hop and fables meet. Hey, grown-ups, listen to Once Upon a Beat early and ad-free right now on Wondery Plus.
Once Upon a Beat.